Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for real estate investors looking to protect their assets, save on taxes, and build their wealth with Clint Coons. Clint is an attorney, author, avid real estate investor, and featured instructor at Anderson's tax and asset protection events held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
Welcome, everyone. Hi, it's Clint Coons here with Anderson Business Advisors, and this is another episode of our weekly podcast. And I know with all the turmoil out there when it comes to investing, you're probably wondering, where should I be putting my money right now? Is it safe to go back into single family? Should I go into commercial or should I do multifamily? And in fact, you know, coming up to this entire crisis, multifamily was one of the hottest areas for investors. I went to multiple conferences where people were out there teaching how to get started in multifamily, or they were putting together syndications, which, you know, if you're just getting started, you shouldn't be making this leap on your own. You should actually work with an experienced syndicator who has been doing this and understands the market. And so I've seen some changes taking place, as you heard on prior podcasts. I've talked with some of the investments I've made in the last 3 months. Some of it has been multifamily. I never expected that this year would be the first year where I personally got involved in multifamily properties. In fact, with everything that's going on right now, I was able to close on two killer deals that changed specifically because of the market. That is, the seller, prior to all this COVID going on, was steadfast in their terms, price, everything. But once this hit, contacted me a couple weeks later into the middle of this, and they were like, whatever it takes, I want out. And so it really intrigued me. And so it went the opposite of where I thought things were going to go. And I think that as real estate investors, we need to know all of our investment opportunities, where we can go out there to put our money, because these are times where I think there are plenty of opportunities for investing. In fact, it reminds me of 2008, 9, and 10, where a lot of individuals, you know, they got scared. They backed away from the market because they heard people that lost money in real estate. That is always, in my opinion, the time to buy. When everyone else is pulling away, that's when I want to go in. So on this episode, what I want to do is talk with a good friend of mine who is an experienced real estate investor when it comes to multifamily investing. He's been investing for 15 years. He's done dozens of projects, and he has a unique perspective. He has his thumb on the pulse of the market. And I thought, if you're listening into this podcast and you want to get involved in multifamily, then we should have an expert on that can discuss with us some of the benefits, what's going on out there, what he's seeing, his funds that he's putting together, what he's looking at. Should he be diversifying now into other asset classes as well, so that we're making informed decisions? So with that, I want to introduce Matt Faircloth. Matt, how are you doing?
I'm awesome, Clint. Thank you so much for having me here.
Hey, thanks for coming on. I know you're really busy right now. I mean, we all seem to be busier than we were before because everybody wants to do podcasts and Zoom meetings. So it's kind of crazy.
It is. Obviously, we couldn't have predicted this circumstance that we as a world would have been in even just 6 months ago. And then when this thing started to roll through the U.S. in March, well, you know, we all kind of thought it was going to end up a certain way. And I didn't realize that I was going to be, as you said, even more busier, but just in a different way now than I was just back then. So it's been like a crazy sci-fi movie in a lot of ways.
Oh, I know. I mean, you and I were just in Colorado right before everybody started shutting everything down. I think it was a week and a half beforehand. We're like, oh, let's just get on the phone next week. And that couldn't happen. That
was only a month and a half ago, Clint, but it feels like a year ago.
Wow, that's so true. You're right. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
No. Or it just happens to be that we're getting older and everything, it's hard to remember.
No, I know. It is. We're just getting right. My brain's just getting rusty. So,
yeah. Well, hey, you know, we got a bunch of listeners on here, and I start telling you about, you know, those two deals that I've done this year that I've saw sellers, you know, they came back to me and wanted to unload these properties. So maybe we start out, before we go that deep, is what are your thoughts right now? What are you seeing in the market?
Well, it's funny. So we're multifamily, and we're also in, we also own some smaller assets and things like that. As you said, I've been doing this for 15 years. Our primary affinity right now is multifamily assets in more like not like A plus markets, but more just tertiary working class markets in that. So we were looking at we've looked at deals, and it's become the running joke with me and my acquisitions manager about, you know, is that a pre-COVID or a post-COVID price? Because we've seen so many deals that, I mean, this is new stuff to the market where it's like they're not even acknowledging that anything's changed, and they're putting out pricing and cap rates and things like that, and, you know, big assumptions of increase and everything, and I guess crossing their fingers and hoping that things are just going to go right back to where they were, and that we're just going to elastic back in that. So those have been just interesting, and people not coming down to reality. But I've also seen and heard of sellers getting way more real on their prices. And I mean, again, it's too soon to see any real true financial distress. You're not going to see foreclosures. You're not going to see bank-owned properties coming online, because it takes a while for banks to take possession of these things. Now, I also don't believe that most multifamily is going to get to that point, because I think that banks got ahead of this thing and started helping their owners and started doing deferments and assistance and forbearance if they need it and things like that. So I don't think we're going to see blood in the streets. Sorry, those of you guys listening, that I don't see the multifamily market getting cut in half anytime soon. But what I do see is that folks that were looking to sell, that maybe were even under contract to sell pre-COVID, have gotten much more realistic because of COVID and have dropped their prices to factor in COVID-related reality. I think that's what I'm seeing. And I think that we'll continue to see a correction in the market, but not blood in the streets, everything half price, like some folks may have been hoping they're going to see. I don't believe that's going to happen. I think we're just going to see maybe a 10% drop, and it's already starting to show up in some markets and on some properties.
Okay. Well, then I was listening in to a presentation, and it had to do with financing. And I forget the name of the group that was putting this on. They were talking about the equity markets and what's going on there. And one of the things that they brought up is that there are certain funding sources now that are starting to dry up, and there's been a pullback on access to capital, especially on the institutional side, because they're concerned about the asset class itself and appraisals. So what do you think is going to happen there, for individuals as far as being able to gain access to cash to buy them?
So we saw that too. And what's interesting is we saw there was some blood in the streets, but it was people that just kind of got caught. It was almost like a roulette wheel. They kind of get caught at the wrong time. Like, the world started to shut down around March 15th. And there were closings that were scheduled somewhere between March 5th. Let's just say you're scheduled anywhere between March 15th and March 30th. I heard horror stories of banks like canceling deals at the table, while you go to the closing with your pen and a bottle of champagne looking to pop the cork that you just closed on an apartment building or on a deal, and the banks are recalling the deal at closing saying, hey, listen, we're not going to fund this. And that's caused many buyers to, get left high and dry with their deposits, and buyer and seller had to either renegotiate or repackage or just say, okay, sorry, we didn't make it to the table. Up through, I just described what happened in March. April, everything kind of went to sleep. And the only lenders that were active were agencies, were Fannie and Freddie, but they also had put in a lot of restrictions on what you had to bring to the table to close a deal. Let's say you and I are going to buy a 100-unit apartment building deal. And equity you and I have to put together is $2 million. Fair enough. Okay. So we put it together either out of our own pockets or from equity, from investors. We assemble the deal. Now, if we were doing an agency loan, that would have been a closable transaction up until the agency changed their terms. And what they changed it to say was, okay, Clint and Matt, we want you guys now to bring all the equity to the table, but we also want you to bring up to 18 months worth of interest and principal to the table. If you're going to have an amortized mortgage, I'm going to bring you 18 months worth of interest and up to 12 months worth of taxes and insurance. And on a larger property, that could be, you could be looking at $20,000 to $30,000 a month in debt service. That's not unreasonable to have it on a larger deal. So what's, 18 times that, right? Plus the 12 months worth of real estate taxes. So you and I may be required last second to come up with, let's say, another $500,000. to close a deal. Now, we have to bring all that to the table in our own cash or an investor cash. And yes, they do give it back to you after, say, 12 months of good performance. They will return that capital, right? But that first year could really stink from a cash-on-cash return perspective. And if you calculate the IRR that your deal has and the cash-on-cash that a deal has, that additional capital to the table killed a lot of deals that Fannie and Freddie were doing. Now, that's April. Okay. Where we are now is a lot of bridge lenders are starting to come back in. What a bridge lender is in essence someone who will take a dilapidated piece of real estate and they will help you bridge where you stand today to the point where you can refinance them out to agency debt, right? Slightly riskier. A lot of times the rates are floating, meaning the rates change every month. And there's a lot of terms and carve outs and a lot of teeth in those loans. And if you don't behave well on those loans, they can sink those teeth pretty quickly into you. But they're intended to bridge you from a dilapidated property up to agency debt. Mind you, agency debt typically won't do a deal that's not 90% occupied. So if you and I are looking at a real dog that's, 60%, 70% occupied, we could get for a great deal. I can't use Fannie or Freddie on that. And when Fannie or Freddie were the only kids left on the playground in April, a lot of those dilapidated deals had nowhere to go. No, you couldn't finance them. The bridge lenders are just now starting, and it's not like pop the champagne, we're back to normal again. They're just now beginning to get back into the space. Their rates are higher, their loans to value terms are lower. They're way more finicky, but they're starting to do deals again, which is exciting.
Yeah, so for the listeners that aren't familiar with this, what it means is that the bridge lender is going to help these individuals stabilize the property, mm-hmm. Get up to 90, 95% occupancy, do the rehab work if anything needs to be done to make sure that it passes the agency inspection, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. And what's great is any syndicator, that wasn't doing agency debt pretty much had to go bridge. And they've been great programs. We've used them regularly. They'll lend to you a sizable amount of the purchase price, and they'll also give you a sizable amount of your construction budget. So if you and I were going to go and buy a dilapidated apartment building that, was built in 1960 and hasn't been touched since then, right? Because we all know that apartment building. Mm-hmm. I probably lived in a few of them in my youth, in that. So there's plenty of buildings out there that just need a really good facelift to bring them up to market conditions and have people willing to pay market rents for those properties, right? But facelifting a 100-unit apartment building can take a lot of money. So you got to update the kitchens. You got to maybe redo all the roofs because maybe all the roofs are original. There's a lot of original, fit out that could be there that we just need to update. That takes a big budget. It could take millions to update these apartment buildings. What's great is the bridge lenders will produce that construction dollar for you, and they'll also produce a good amount of acquisition. Bridge loans are really what turned around a lot of apartment buildings in America over the last 10 years. And so they're great products if you use them properly. They can be weapons of destruction if you don't, but they can be great product to get you into those coveted agency loans that are super low interest rates, super long rate locks, non-recourse, meaning there's no personal guarantee required. So they're great products, but the agencies have a lot of things that they require, including occupancy. So the bridge helps you get there, and they're great vehicles. And it was a real shame when they went dry for a while, but as I understand, they're getting back in slowly. But they're getting back in.
Okay, but let's assume that I'm a single family operator. I have mm-hmm. about 8 or 9 homes, mm-hmm. and I'm enticed by the idea of moving into multifamily. So I'm going to look for maybe a 60 unit complex, 40 right. to 60 units. So if I needed that bridge money and I wanted to find a bridge lender out there, I mean, are they going to loan to me, or do I not meet the criteria that I'm lendable because I don't have the experience?
No, you got to produce a balance sheet, meaning mm-hmm. Let's run with that 60 unit example for a minute. So the typical deal in most tertiary markets that I deal in is around $50,000 a unit, right? So a 60 unit deal, that's 1.8 million in a buy price, right? Plenty lenders are not going to touch that deal because it's going to be too small for their lending requirements. Most lenders want to get in, 2 to 3 million, the bridge lenders do. But let's just say for conversation's sake, you find one, right, that will take a deal that small. You're gonna pay a little bit more in interest rate. A larger bridge lender may charge today's market between 6 and 7, pre-COVID between 5 and 6, right? But their rates are higher now. And for that deal you just talked about, that someone's scaling up and getting into larger product, they may be in the 8s, they could be in the 9s, You know, it's possible, but guess what? That means they get to buy that 60 unit, they get to rehab it, and they get to move it over to agency eventually. The only thing that they need to have, Clint, is they've got to have that balance sheet. So let's say, as I said, the property value, you know, buy price is 1.8. They need to show they've got a good chunk of that sitting in liquid cash. So let's say 10% of the loan amount sitting in liquid cash in their bank account. So show me where you've got $180,000 in cash that you could bail this property out. God forbid something happens in that. And also show you've got a net worth. Some lenders' requirements are different, but normally they require net worth that's at or equal to the loan amount. So for a $1.8 million property, you might be borrowing, you know, 1.4 somewhere in there. So you're going to show you got a net worth of 1.4. And they'll consider everything. It's not like accredited investor calculations. You can consider your home. Yep. Yeah, you can throw that in there, all that stuff. Retirement accounts, everything you got. But then the challenge for most investors is to show that liquidity, because who sits around with that kind of cash just sitting on the shelf? You know, mm-hmm. Most people put their cash to work. And so you've got to be able to show that. Now you can bring in a loan sponsor, like somebody you might know that has that amount of liquidity, or even just, you know, liquid stocks that they could liquidate to help you out in the deal. So you can assemble balance sheets, but one way or another, if you can show that you have somewhat of a track record and a balance sheet, these bridge lenders, they're not going to turn you down. I mean, they might tie you up in a personal guarantee for that size deal, but you can still get the deal done. And it's a good segue. Short story, my first true big multifamily was a 49 unit. So almost exactly what you just talked about. And then that's how we got into the larger multi-space, was with a 49 unit. And it was a good stepping stone.
So those loans, what are the typical terms? I mean, how long are they? Are the prepayment penalties?
Yes and no. Okay. So they know that you're going to be bridging into Fannie and Freddie. Their purpose is not to be your amortized long-term lender. They want to have a beginning, middle, and an end to your loan, period. Rates, as I said, can be, you know, in the eights or nines, even on the smaller stuff, and on the bigger stuff, you might be able to get them down to the sixes or sevens. Loan to value today is between 70 and 75% from what I'm being told for deals that we're looking at. Used to be 80, not anymore. Yep. Used to be 100% of construction. You're probably going to see less than that now. And they also require that you do the work and then they'll reimburse you. So yes, it's 100% of construction, but they're not going to go and give you the money to replace all your roofs and then you go replace the roofs. They're going to expect you to go replace the roofs and they'll come and inspect them and say, okay, yes, those are replaced roofs and we'll now give you a reimbursement for your expenses. So you gotta have enough cash to front the construction and then they'll reimburse you behind. Their origination is going to be somewhere between 1-2% of the loan amount. That's called points. And then a lot of times they kind of get you on the way out the door, Clint, too. So they may require that your loan be, let's say it's a 3-year loan. They loan you and me, you know, 1.4 million to go and redo that 60 unit you're talking about, plus construction on top. So they'll say, okay, guys, this is a great project. We love it. It's 3 years. Now, what we want to see is we want to see that you're going to guarantee us interest for 18 months. And so if you and I are really good businessmen and we get that property turned around and we browbeat our contractors and crack the whip and get that turnaround done and wipe the sweat from my brow and got all that work done and we get it done in 12 months, and we qualify for a refi, well, guess what? That lender is going to say, hey, listen, that's awesome. Congratulations. But you owe me 6 more months worth of interest. So we may have to pay additional interest at closing. You know, you could pay upwards of a year worth of interest at closing. That's number one. Number two, a lot of these lenders have something called an exit fee, which it's not prepayment penalties, but it kind of is. But all that is instead of charging you everything up front on origination, maybe they might charge you 1% on origination when you get the loan and then another percent on the loan when you exit from the loan at the end. They kind of kick in the rear on the way out the door in that. So they can ding you on the back end getting out. And you have to be very cautious of knowing what those expenses can be, because they can really drop down your refi proceeds when you're refinancing these bridge loans. It's important to read all the fine print in those loan documents.
Exactly. You're only make that mistake once.
Yeah.
I'm saying that from experience.
I know, because I did. That's where the gray hair on this side of my head came from, Clint, was from that one deal.
I know.
And it's important to have attorneys like your firm review those loan docs, man, because you got to, it's fine tooth comb. You got to break out the microscope. Don't expect that you're going to, people joke, a little bit of light readings, if in case you can't sleep, read these loan documents. No, read the loan docs and get a brew a cup of coffee, make sure you're wide awake, and then read the loan docs, you know?
Yeah, and reread them.
Yeah. There's a lot of teeth in there. There's a lot of teeth in those loan docs. You got to make sure that, you uncover any way that they can get you, or any if, thens, and whats.
So how do you compare what's going on now to what went on back in, 2009, 10, that time frame?
It's funny. I'm, lucky enough or whatever to have been around. I'm one of the few apartment building guys or real estate guys that have been around since then. I got started in 2005. What I view the, 2008, 2009 crisis to be, that was a debt crisis. That was a bunch of lenders who had their sources of capital, the warehouse lines that they were had access to, and the Wall Street product, and the mortgage-backed security markets and things like that, that they relied on to create loans. All that crumbled, right? And so that made it very hard to get a loan. And a lot of loans that had been propped up on a house of cards that had been poorly underwritten or badly created or just probably should have never happened. I don't know if you saw the big, those kind of loans that they were talking about in that movie. That's what that was. And that was just a recorrection of a market that had gotten way overheated on lending. What I believe this to be is, again, this is just Matt Fairclough's humble opinion. I'm not an economist or anything like that. I'm just a, just a boots on the ground kind of guy. But I believe this is a income crisis. And this is just different. This is the other side of the spectrum. This is not the loans. This is the income that supports those loans. This is making sure that America can pay their bills still, and that the folks that live in these rental properties still have the income that they can make their mortgage payments. I don't think we're seeing anywhere near like a liquidity issue on the debt side. This is all about cash flow and about people pumping their own earned income into the economy to keep things going, and supporting local restaurants and supporting local businesses and everything like that. And then that cash they put in a local business then flowing into the next thing, and just the cash flow economy, the cash cycle. We've lost the biggest consumer, which is middle America and all of America, really. All the income earners are all sitting on their hands right now, and we're the ones that keep the economy going. And I think that why everything's kind of stopped is because, nobody's spending their earned income, because either people don't have it anymore or they're waiting to see what happens. And so they're sitting on their hands and cutting back their expenses, and businesses are closing because there's nobody walking in the doors anymore. So that's my view on this. But again, that is through Matt Fairclough's glasses, not necessarily, the truth, but that's what I see.
If you're evaluating a market and where to invest, I would say now it's going to become really, really important. I mean, it was important before too, but those tenants, predominantly, what type of jobs do they hold? Because if they're in the service industry that has taken a major hit and it's probably going to be slow to recover, do you factor that in? It's like, well, maybe that's, I would have gone into that market 2019, but 2020, now I'm going to go to a market where there's a little more stability,
Well, I do now, Clint. I didn't do that a couple months ago, but I do now because we have been a tertiary market C-class housing investor, because in 2008, I owned a lot of C-class housing. And guess what, man? We didn't have a hiccup on rent prices. Now, all of a sudden, the property that you owned that was worth $200,000 was now worth $100,000 because you couldn't get a loan on it anymore. And maybe it was propped up on a bad loan. But with enough appreciation and with enough cash flow and everything like that, things came back around. And that, so we got stuck holding some properties longer than we wanted to in 2008. But guess what? They still cash flowed. The reason why is because rents never dipped in 2008 on the middle America stuff, on the C and B class properties. We didn't see a rent correction. And so that's what was interesting. And most of the folks that worked in those markets didn't really see an income crisis. They kept their jobs. They didn't see major layoffs. A lot of the layoffs happened at the top in those markets. And people that earn in the middle or towards the median of a market can typically find another job pretty easily, and that they can just change careers, whatever it is. And that's what happened to a lot of our tenants. So what's happening now is the folks that can continue to work, that can, work from home, or that can, do what you and I are doing and stay productive, they're able to keep going. But that's not middle America. That's not the C-class tenant. That's not workforce housing. The workforce housing tenant is relying on subsidies from the government. They're relying on unemployment and those things. And they're hoping that things open up very quickly, or they're in essential service-based industry. So these are your doctor. I'm sorry. Yeah, well, not doctors, but your nurses, your police officers. Believe it or not, a lot of my tenants work construction. Those guys are still working. in most markets in that. So we've got lucky enough, but we've had many tenants that lost their jobs or have had a shortage of income or are now relying on unemployment to be able to pay their rent. So this, I believe, is affecting a different side of the market currently. Now, I have a prediction on what's going to happen in the future, but that's, again, that's just me. So,
You're talking about construction. I mean, One of the things that I was thinking about the other day, I was talking to my brother. He's in, he has an asphalt business. He's monitoring how many permits people are starting to put in for, you know, depending on how long the permitting process is. Because in an area where he is currently doing a lot of work on the asphalt side, he said, hey, yeah, I'm going to be busy through the entire season, but next year, they're not permitting, they're not pulling anything to do any building in this area because they're expecting to take a big hit there.
Well, Clint, I believe a lot of people that are doing, a lot of the construction folks are finishing what they started.
Yep.
You know, and it was just so pre-COVID, we were in the middle of a big reno on a project in Trenton. We were turning probably 4 to 5 apartments a week in a few of our rental market. You know, we just, you know, just go and take that dilapidated apartment building and upgrade the units and do new kitchens and all that kind of stuff, right? So we're still employing a bunch of people doing that kind of work. Now, I'm already down the road, okay? So I got to finish that. You know, it's not like I can say, okay, you know, COVID, we're going to stop turning apartments. I got people looking to rent. We're going to keep going. We're working on a land deal in a couple of markets to go and build on some land in some other markets. And we're not sure if that's going to go anywhere because we're looking at, you know, well, do we really think that the market's going to go up another 10% for us to be able to, you know, really, really squeeze the lemon on this deal? Do we think there might be a pullback? I don't know. So we're a lot more cautious on looking a year out versus looking the next like 4 months out. My binoculars are a lot clearer there than they are a year out. It's a lot different than it used to be until just recently.
Well, even a year and a half ago, one thing I was noticing with Class A properties, like just say Seattle, ton of buildings going on for multifamily, and they're just pumping all these things. But then they're having a problem, I think, in filling the properties.
Yeah.
That there's an oversupply. Because you would drive down the street and one guy would say, yeah, you get 3 months of free rent. And the next one would be like, oh, we'll give you a free car if you sign a lease.
Wow.
You know, just throwing out goodies to entice people to rent from them.
I had a buddy, I had a friend that renewed his lease in Philadelphia and his landlord gave him 3 months for signing a 2-year lease. You know, and this is recent. This was probably 6 months ago. And that this is, you know, pre-COVID and all that, but it was still one of those things where you start to look at that. I mean, I think that certain areas are overbuilt, like Seattle and Philly and the A-class markets and stuff like that. That's on the other side of the coin. A lot of the tertiary, like C-class markets, even B-class markets are are underbuilt. And I think there's actually a need, there's a shortage for housing in a lot of the middle of the road markets, but in the higher end markets, I think there's a glut of housing.
So where are you looking then?
We're sticking to what we know how to do. We're really great at taking apartment buildings that exist, upgrading them, turning them around. I'd like to see, I'm looking for stuff that cash flows now. So I'm not looking for, you know, I mean, a lot of people in my market will like, okay, if it doesn't cash flow in year one, I get it because it's a pig. You know, I got to clean it up and knock the dust off of it and get it performing again and everything like that. And it's okay that it doesn't make any money in the first or maybe even second year. We're not okay with that anymore. I'm looking for deals that cash flow, you know, now, the sooner than later. And so that means I'm going to have to pay a higher cap rate, or that's all I'm going to pay for deals. I'm not going to pay for stuff that's, you know, big value add, but I want to get something that makes some money now that I can still squeeze the lemon to make further. And earlier I was okay with deals that didn't make much now, if anything at all, for the opportunity to squeeze the lemon really big in the future. So yeah, a lot less risk, looking for a lot more stability. We are looking at new construction because it's interesting that if you can time new construction properly, you could probably build through the recession. Because, you know, most folks most of the circles you and I are in, folks talk about like, okay, we're going to come out of this. We'll probably pop the champagne and have like a little bit of a celebration time and have the economy rip roar for a month or two. And then the real ripple effect of this thing is going to hit and we'll be in a recession for the foreseeable future, right? So that's interesting because recession means everything pulls back. But maybe you build something that's able to get put on the market once we start coming out of this thing, because recessions typically last somewhere around 18 months. So if the recession started now, or it started a couple months ago, likely, then we'll be out of this thing like somewhere towards the end of 2021, right? So I'm intrigued by that model to slow build if that makes sense. So yeah, I think your brother's right. The 2021 may stink, but the end of 2021 is when we might start to look towards recovery. And wouldn't it be interesting to have something to be ready for release then?
Yeah. So you basically timed it. So what are some of the mistakes you see that people wanting to get started in this area, they typically make?
Well, I think that folks think that the other shoe's already dropped and they're waiting and they're like licking their chops to get in. But I think that they don't realize that what the pause button is on right now. And yes, lending is starting to wake up. And what's funny is folks that are offering deals are still talking, you know, pre-COVID prices and everything like that. But I don't think we've seen the real effects of this yet. And I think that the mistakes I've seen people make is to jump in and come in too cavalier and think that they can time when they're going to jump in on things. Back to my comment about building something to time it, it still scares me because it's still trying to time the market. And I think that most folks lose when they try and do that because the market can be very unwieldy, you know? So I think that taking uncalculated risks is a big mistake I've seen people make or trying to stretch today. Because it's just, we're in a big unknown, you know, not 100% sure what things are going to look like in the next month.
And I just, sometimes people, the idea of owning a multifamily property is put in front of, you know, the numbers and the common sense that should go behind it. And I see people falling into these traps.
The last 3 or 4 years, Clint, is a lot of people, I've spoken at events. I spoke at a lot of Bigger Pockets conferences and I've spoken at a lot of, you know, back when it was okay to speak in public, you know, as you did too. I did a lot of that. And I used to always just for fun do show of hands. Okay. Who's looking to flip houses right now? You know, like, you know, maybe 5% of the room, right? Who's looking at wholesale? You'd see more hands go up because it's their perception that wholesaling is a vehicle to get into real estate if you don't have any money. Not really true, but people think that that's the case. And so maybe 20% of the room would raise hands. I said, okay, who wants to get into multifamily? And the entire room would raise their hand. You know, it's been put on this like pedestal that it's like the end all be all, like, you know, buy a multifamily and it's like an ATM machine that starts spitting out checks for $1 million, you know? And then it's
that's mobile home parks, I've been told.
Right. Yeah. Right. And it's the one and only key to financial freedom. And people have their blinders on so much. It's I think coveted more than it should be. It's a good asset. It's a great asset for a lot of fundamental reasons, but not because that everyone should be chasing it. I think it's overchased. Pre-COVID, it was overchased. Yet to be seen on if that chase is going to continue or not after COVID.
So now that we're in this flux, I mean, you're still investing. Are you changing your mix, what you're looking at, what you're doing?
Yeah, so we've decided to diversify. I mean, the model up until now has been to transfer a lot of risk to investors. Investors don't realize that, but that's what syndicators have been doing up until now, is they've been transferring most of the risk over to investors. Think about it. All the deals that we do are non-recourse, right? So they're not going to come get my house if this deal goes under, you know? There's no personal guarantee for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm not touting my chest. I'm saying me as in the collective me of all syndicators, right? The investors are beholden into a pref, but there's no guarantee the syndicator has to pay that. I've seen deals where there's the pref, a preferred return to investors, but there was no plan to pay that until after the property refinanced, or maybe even after the deal was done. Maybe out of the out sale, the pref would get caught up on, right? And then investors were entitled to an enormous part of the upside, like 70% of the upside on a property, which means the syndicator is only making 30% of the profit and everybody's okay with that. But when you look at it, the syndicator actually doesn't have much to lose, aside from a reputation, but they don't have much to lose on deals like that. So they're very investor risk centered. The investors really is the one who stands to take the most risk. Meaning potential to lose their equity and potential for their profit to be taken on the deal. They're not going to get the returns they thought they were going to get, right? So we're taking a lot of that risk back and we're going to be bringing it onto ourselves and just offering investors maybe something with not an enormous upside potential. But as you know, the higher the risk that something is, the higher the return it has to pay. And so like that's why you see stuff. I mean, if somebody's presenting me a deal that's, hey, Matt, I got this deal that's going to make a 40% return. My immediate thing is, okay, what's the risk? Because if you're offering me a 40% return, that means you got to pay me that 40% return for me to be willing to pallet that risk. right? Well, think about it. It's a two-side coin. So we're going to be taking a lot of that risk back and offering investors a nice, stable rate of return with lots of tax benefits. We're also going to make it liquid, meaning like that we're going to introduce liquidity, which is something that's not been involved in today's market. So we're going to give people diversity that they can be invested in a couple of different, you know, projects all at once with their dollars, and they can recall it. So they say, okay, Matt, listen, I need to pull my dollars back because I find something better, or because God forbid the recession hits and I need that cash for my, for, you know, to uphold my homestead or something like that, I can recall it. And so we're going to make it recallable, liquid, with stable rates of return, and we're going to be taking on the risk. Yes, we're going to make the upside, but I think that investors are going to be okay with that in exchange for liquidity, solidarity, and monthly payments they can count on, and not like, you know, wait till the end of the deal to get your pref and that kind of thing. So,
yeah, you see, that I think is key, what you just said there. My partner and I, we did a small deal earlier this year just on single families. And what we offered, we did our raise and said, listen, you want your money back in 3-year time frame? We'll give you all your money back. And the reason why we were able to do, why we were willing to do something like that, is because I want the homes that we were buying, that we bought, I'll put in my own portfolio. So if somebody wants out, yeah, you can have all your money back. I don't care, because I'm buying for the cash flow. And so that, I think, is what you're saying, is that you're so invested in these, you see the long-term value in this project, you want to keep it. So that's a lot of difference than someone who's not saying, listen, you know, they're trying to flip the property right and move on to something else. So I think, to me as an investor, you know, and doing a deal like that, that gives me more comfort.
Yeah.
Knowing that you're willing to do it.
Through the right set of glasses, it does. Yeah. And investors need to get away from the concept of like, well, if I go on CrowdStreet, I see that there's a deal that's returning a 24% IRR, you know, and like, well, listen, I can make any deal show you a 24% IRR. Yeah. All you have to do is increase the sell price on the back end, increase what it refinances for, and hocus pocus, I got that same deal on CrowdStreet, you know. But that, just because it's there with those IRRs, doesn't mean there's no guarantee in there. And it's all, you know, speculative. And if you look at the deal, a lot of that profit that you propose to make is on the back end. Now, folks are seeing through these things now, and they realize the back end of the, of these upsell on properties might not exist, might not sell them for what we think we're going to sell them for in the future. And that, so I think that investors are going to take security and predictability over risk in the next couple of years, and that. And I think that we're trying to stay ahead of that, for what people want, and produce something that's going to meet that.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. I know, because in this time, if you're going to get into this space, you really want to work with someone who knows what they're doing. I mean, there's too many unknowns. And I talked to a lot of clients that have been bringing this up, and I just said, hey, you know, learn from the experts, and then maybe look at it when things calm down. But to me, it's not the right time to do it on your own.
No, no. And that's why we created, you know, just as you have, we've got a community of people that can come and pick our brain when they want to, and that. I mean, just it pays to work, to kind of be underneath an umbrella of a larger operator that knows what they're doing, that's got maybe got a few grays on their head, and has been through a few market cycles like we have and stuff like that. So that's why we created our insider, DeRosa Insiders community, which folks can join for, you know, not much. I think it's $24, $24 a month they can join. But that gives the right to pick my brain and to have, you know, we kind of look out for them. We just posted on, it's funny, it's like a feeding frenzy. It's like chum to sharks right now. We put on the community that we've got a 16-unit apartment building that's too small for us, and it's down the block from a built from 160 unit that we own. And so the PM staff that run our 160 unit could easily run the 16 unit. It's right there. It's right next to it. And so there's a lot of newish investors that are hopping in on this, that want to be a part of this smaller deal. And it's like this feeding frenzy going on, which is great, but you got to have an operator that can watch your six on something like that, which we can, because we're right down the street, you know, and that. So I think that with the changes going on, I would not venture out on my own in a market like this. I would definitely look to be a part of a larger whole, be a part of a team, whatever. It's just too much to know, and things are changing too rapidly to be on your own trying to figure it out right now.
No, I agree. And having access to something like what you just said, I mean, $25, that's ridiculous. Not only get to be able to ask you questions, but also to find other individuals that, you know, that you're part of, that are doing deals, and you can bounce ideas off them, because they're going to bring experience. It's like a mini mastermind. Yeah. The link's going to in the show notes. So when you're listening in, you can go to the show notes, you can click on the link, and it'll take you there. So if you're interested in signing up for that, guys, definitely, if this is a space that you want to be in and you want to get more information, I've seen people selling classes for $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. For $25 a month, this is a great way to start and then start building your knowledge, especially have access to someone like that.
Absolutely. And, you know, and it's okay. I've paid money like that for courses and stuff like that. It's all about the deliverable. It's one thing if you're getting just a weekend class and weekend exposure to stuff and everything like that. I put that a little bit lower on the pedestal versus a community. And I think at this point, if you're getting access to professionals, you can pick their brain on a regular basis. And if you're becoming a part of a community, regardless of what the price tag is, you know, if you're getting that, then I think that it really enables you to tighten up, because it's just too much to know right now. Things are changing too much. You need a group that you can bounce ideas off of and people that are getting information you don't have. Because there's new information coming out every day. The whole thing that I just told you about how loans are changing and everything like that, I just got access to that data last week.
Yeah.
And before that, the bridge lenders weren't in the market, but I just found out last week that they're coming back in. So I jumped in, figured it out. What are we doing? And I put it out to my community because people need to know these things. And just the information is coming out so quickly that you've got to have a community that can keep you in touch.
Well, hey, we're out of time. I mean, this went so fast. And
man, that covered it.
I know it did, didn't it, right?
Yeah.
Because before we got started, you're like, well, how long is this going to be? And I said, well, probably about 25, 30 minutes. And
here we are.
45, 50. Yeah, there it is. So thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it. So everybody, if they want to get a hold of you, we got the links in the show notes. Are there any parting comments you want to leave?
No, yeah, check out those links. We'd love to have you join our communities. And I would say on a grander scale, not to like pat everybody in the back, but this too shall pass, because we're not going back to the way things were a couple months ago, but we're definitely going to a better place soon. And there's going to be some fallout, but I don't think that the sky is going to fall and that we need to, you know, stock up with cases of cans of soup and bottled water and toilet paper in our basements or anything like that. I think that we're going to be okay. I just think that we need to tighten up as a world and as a community to get through this thing together. And the more you look at things that way, I think that the better off we're all going to be.
Yeah. You know, one thing you didn't mention, I'm going to do it for you, is the fact that you're a best-selling author on Amazon, and you wrote the book Raising Private Capital.
I forgot to go there. Yeah, I wrote the book. They can check that out. They can go to that's on my website, derosagroup.com. They can buy a copy of it, or they can buy it on BiggerPockets or they can pick it up from Amazon too, wherever they want. It's all over. And I'm just so grateful that the world picked it up as much as it did. And it's as you said, it's an Amazon bestseller, and I'm super grateful that it's there. And that everybody, you know, checked it out and picked it up and wrote so many great comments about it on Amazon, and that it's built such a movement behind it, because the premise of the book briefly is that everyone knows people with money. You don't need to come to me for money. You don't need to come to anybody else for money. The odds are, you know, millions of dollars worth of contacts in your personal cell phone. Everybody does. You just don't know where to look for it. And my book teaches you how to look in your own network for the money that you need for your own deals.
Absolutely. That's so important. And for those listeners, I've done another podcast with Dugan Kelly, who's a syndication attorney that then we'll show you, once you've found that type of money in those individuals, how to structure it the right way. So be sure to check that one out as well on our podcast.
Absolutely.
Yeah, talking about that, because I think you know Dugan as well.
I do.
And yeah, good guy.
Great guy. Yeah, great guy. And it's so important, just for your firm and for Dugan's firm and whatnot, it's so important to have a good lawyer behind you, because there's so many ways that in real estate and in business in general, you can get tripped up. And so it's just important to have a lawyer watching your six that can keep you out of trouble, like your firm and like Dugan's firm as well.
So I tell him, you want to make sure you got somebody there to save your ass.
Yes.
Right?
Save my assets. Right. I love it. I like that.
All right, partner. Good talking to you.
Thanks, Clint.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at andersonadvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast. And if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.